Hello, and welcome to the latest episode in the Enterprise Time Security Podcast series. My name is Ian Murphy, and my guest today is Michael McCabe, founder and CEO of Intelligence Fusion. We're going to be talking about business risk awareness, a topic that spans both cybersecurity and physical security. The latter, of course, is often overlooked by businesses when they send staff away or establish offices. But as we've discovered in the last few months alone, you need to understand what the situation is on the ground before you start deploying staff. Hi, Michael.
Hello, I'm Michael McCabe, the CEO and founder of Intelligence Fusion. Intelligence Fusion is a threat intelligence data provider and software development company specializing in custom intelligence platforms.
The phrase business risk awareness is something most people would think is an insurance thing. Can you give us a bit more of an overview as to what it covers?
It's very much about what your frame of reference is. I take my career as an example. I was trained in the British Army. Risk awareness in the British Army was very different to when I left and went into the private sector and was working for the likes of Olive Group or Aegis with oil and gas companies. I was going from thinking about terrorism and conflict to then thinking about actual business risks, but very much in a post-conflict environment of Iraq. Fast forward to Intelligence Fusion. We've been going 5 years. From a business risk awareness aspect, my frame of reference is very different. It's a much more commercial. We have a risk register as part of the company. It's around things like not hitting financial targets, as well as personnel issues of us losing key personnel. But then there are particular security risks that are in there as well. If you're coming at business without a security background, it's very easy to overlook the security aspects. The way that things are going at the moment globally, I'm sure some businesses in Capitol Hill in Seattle didn't have on their business continuity and crisis management plan that an autonomous zone was going to break out and they would have to somehow operate with all of this going on around them. So it's very much down to your frame of reference as to how you're coming to business, of which a lot of people are not from a security background. Also trying to look at what is coming up from an intelligence perspective. What sort of scenarios can we see globally from economic collapse through to the rise in extremist groups? Businesses need to have a better understanding going forward as to what sort of risks can impact them.
If we think about physical security for businesses, most organizations would assume that's about having somebody on the door, making sure that the building's properly secured at night. As far as their staff are concerned, unless you have an office in a dangerous city or a dangerous part of a city, people don't really think physical security beyond that. But things are changing rapidly at the moment. How does a company begin to get a handle on those risks that it's likely to face?
It's got to be intelligence-led. The key thing before you do a threat and risk assessment, it's all about understanding the context. What sort of issues are we going to face? You know, when I was working for Aegis in Iraq, and we were providing the close protection for the United States Army Corps of Engineers, a key part of them being able to operate was understanding what is the operating environment like. There's a lot of animosity towards US forces. There were terrorist groups operating there. And that was the broad context that we were operating in. If you're in a major city in Europe, for example, you still have a variety of threats that you have to understand. Everything from low-level criminality all the way through to the top end, like the possibility of being caught up in a terrorist attack. But if you just take COVID-19 as another example, how many businesses actually prepared for some sort of major event like this? It had the redundancies in place and it actually tested that. Probably some large multinationals would have done it, but for small and medium-sized enterprises, they probably didn't. Then they had to react to it on the hoof. A lot of it is initially understanding your surroundings and the intelligence picture, and then you can start to put in place the security measures to try and actually mitigate the threats.
How does a business begin to get the intelligence requirements? They can look around the street, they can pick up a newspaper, they can look at crime reports in the area where they're going to send staff or position an office. But it's much more complicated than that, isn't it?
It is, and it has to be tailored to a business's requirements. Every client that we take on, we sit down with them and we do an actual intelligence collection plan. We say to them, explain to us your business, explain to us what you're trying to achieve, your short, medium and long-term goals. And then we just sit and work through different scenarios and the types of incidents, the types of threats that we think that they will face. That is the starting point. Then we go away and actually start to collect information based on things like the proximity of their locations. We look at their supply chains. We look at key choke points within the business and areas where they need better information, which allowed them to actually prevent these threats having a significant impact. But that is an ever-moving issue. We'll sit with them probably every quarter and go through the collection plan and just say, look, this is what we've gathered. How are you finding the intelligence reporting? Does it need to be updated? Are your operations changing? it has to be continually changing and evolving. When I did the Control Risk Security Managers course, they were really pushing a report by Demos called The Business of Resilience, which is a really good initiative. It's essentially trying to get the entire organization to be thinking about security and risk, not just seeing the security department as being this entity which is very much enclosed and has no real impact on the business. It's trying to get everybody within the organization to think about security and risk and helping to make the business more resilient.
That greater engagement of the entire business can be difficult. If you and I talk to 100 businesses, the likelihood of HR having much engagement with security, apart from having people marched off the premises, is probably minimal. Those ultra-large businesses who have to worry about the kidnap of senior executives based on their net worth may have a closer relationship. But for some of the things you're talking about, how do we get HR and the wider business to engage with security and make this a business issue, not something that most people would like to ignore?
If I come back to the business of resilience, part of what they were stating in that report was that with globalization, markets are becoming very crowded. If you're going to actually thrive and be successful as a business and find new markets and increase your revenue, you have to be able to actually go out there and find new opportunity. And a big part of that is about making the business as resilient as possible. I think it has to be top-down driven. You have to get the buy-in from the board, which is absolutely key. But then it has to be more of a cultural aspect to it. All too often, you find you've got old and bald security types who perhaps are not as good as getting across why security is important. The new generation coming through who are more tech savvy, approachable, it is getting better. People are seeing how the world is changing and how much more threat rich it is. And people are having to take this as a significant issue. Look at the levels of criminality in London as an example, but also the terrorism threat and what we're seeing at the moment off the back of COVID-19. I mean, just last night were small riots breaking out in Brixton. It is becoming more focused for people to actually take account of, from a security perspective, their own security. With COVID, with people now working from home, that's created this whole new dynamic as well, which we're having to look at. Everything from the general health and safety of working from home. I've heard horror stories of people living in bedsits and not having enough space to have a table and working on their bed for 3 months, using your own computer equipment and the security, cybersecurity risks that faces, the duty of care from the employer to your staff who are now all based at home and the threats that they now face.
There's a whole pile to unpack in that last response. One thing that comes immediately to mind, you mentioned what happened in Brixton last night. That's the sort of situation that often people can't plan for. When it happens and you have intelligence and you feed that through to security teams, how easy is it for organizations to react, to say to staff, don't go into that area, don't come to that office. If you live here, we're going to make phone calls and make sure you're all right. It's the sort of thing that plays well to a headline, but often is very hard for organizations to codify.
What we're seeing at the moment is a rise in companies trying to expand their business into the crisis communications route, which is already a fairly busy area. And you can see why, you know, from the lowest level, you probably have an email group. A manager will email everyone and say, is everybody okay? And if the person has the email to their phone, depends on whether or not they'll actually respond to that. The next step up, where there's an actual WhatsApp group, but it depends on the size of the organization. The gold level standard, where you have crisis communications tools provided by companies. Immediately, once these sort of scenarios happen, they can send out a message to their staff and saying, are you okay? There's even some great free tools coming through now. I saw one the other day by Google where you can actually set up alerts. Say, for example, you're going on a business trip and you're heading to an office in a part of London. You can actually set up Google to say, I'm going to this location, I'm going to be gone for an hour. If it's anything past an hour, send me a warning. If I don't reply to the warning, it will then send a notification to whoever your crisis contacts are. There are some really good free tools that are coming through, which shows to me that this is becoming something that people are very much aware of, and business and tech companies are starting to try and provide solutions that better respond to the changing threat landscape.
You mentioned COVID-19 and duty of care. Employers have had to scramble to put systems in place. Duty of care has generally been around what's going on in the office or somebody noticing somebody's not well. With people at home, it's stretched and changed all those approaches. The same is true of cybersecurity. We thought we could deal with mobile workers, but actually, when it came down to it, we couldn't deal with mobile workers. Expecting to suddenly find 3,000 extra licenses for our VPN or 5,000 laptops to send out, there wasn't that capacity in the market and organizations weren't set up to do it. What will this mean to business processes? What will it mean to people going through and carrying out MBA and management courses? Is there going to be a significant change in how we begin to view the responsibilities of a business to its employees?
There has to be. We have to react to how people are changing and the way that life operates. From the conversations I'm having, business as usual and operating out of an office is just not going to be what's going to happen going forward. Even if it just gets to a case of people are going to spend half of the week working from home and half of the week hot desking, perhaps the office is shared by another company, things are going to change. But in terms of the threat landscape, COVID had a significant economic impact. The whole George Floyd fallout has caused another significant impact globally. We're seeing Black Lives Matter movements, which are growing, and there are certain aspects of that in terms of we're seeing violence, we're seeing protests, we're seeing demands for the police to be defunded, or in some cases, BLM UK's agenda is to, one, abolish capitalism, but also to abolish the police. The world is changing very, very quickly. Businesses need to actually respond to that rapidly to provide duty of care for their staff. Whatever I sit here now and state, this is how businesses should be reacting to this. Within 2 to 3 months, I'm sure there's going to be another situation that's going to change things again. Better crisis communication, better understanding as to where your staff are, and your staff having the ability to actually alert you to issues is going to be a key issue that businesses need to solve going forward.
I'll come back to crisis communication in a minute. You've mentioned it a couple of times. Before I do that, you talked about how technology was becoming part of the problem. If we think about physical security teams or HR or cybersecurity teams, there's this massive disconnect between all of them. If we're seeing technology as part of the problem, at what point do we look at corporate security teams as a wider responsibility? Where do they sit in HR? Who do they report to? How do they deal with traditional cybersecurity and IT risk? How do they deal with the risk of premises? Surely there needs to be a lot more joined up writing here and a lot more cross training.
If I speak in broad strokes, generally from the cybersecurity side, you have people who are very tech savvy. On the more physical security side, you generally have people who are former police or former military who perhaps aren't as tech savvy. That's in part why there has been quite a disconnect. One side probably doesn't understand the importance or exactly how that aspect of the security really works and why it's so important. But I do think that is changing. It's changing as you have a younger generation of security managers coming through who are a bit more tech savvy and understand more broadly the changing landscape. We speak to people all the time. We spoke to people from a nuclear power facility. And they were saying, from a physical security perspective, we're fine. With all the walls and the guns and everything and the fences that we've got, we face no real issues from physical security. The threats that we face are things like cyber, as well as the insider threat. That is something that is going to grow. You now have people who are more extreme in their thoughts around a variety of different issues, like environmentalism. Going forward, the whole aspect of the insider threat is going to become a lot more important for businesses to look at in terms of their internal processes as to vetting people. The key thing is trying to get the cyber and the physical security people to really understand the importance as to why they should be working together and understanding each other's roles. When we did the training in the military, essentially for intelligence analysts in the British military, you do two aspects. You do operational intelligence, which is the whole pointing at maps and seeing the enemy are here, here, and here. And then you have the counterintelligence side. A big part of it is security consultancy. And it's the holistic aspect of security. It's everything from the fences through to the cyber aspects, through to the protective document registers. It really is understanding that whole army camp and the surrounding areas, really understanding what the threats are from an intelligence perspective and putting in place measures, defense in depth, as it's called in the military. Those aspects need to be brought more into and more well understood in the civilian side and getting the cyber and the physical security to understand each other's roles and why they're so important together.
That same disconnect that an organization has, though, typically sits across the way we gather intelligence. You talked there about the difference between counterintelligence versus where the enemy physically are. You apply that to a business sense and take your example of a nuclear power station. Yes, we've got the, is there somebody trying to break in through the fence, climb over a wall? Is this an insider? That's a whole different group of people. How do you begin to gather that disparate set of intelligence and create a coherent plan that somebody can begin to execute on, rather than feed them bits of information that they've got to try and assemble?
It comes down to tailoring the intelligence feed to the end user. So we've had two iterations of our platform. With the first version, we were just throwing thousands of incidents at clients, and it was just information overload. We learned from that with the second version of the platform, there are far better filtering options. Every incident that we record, we then actually tag the sector that's been impacted by it. You can go into Intelligence Fusion and filter for telecommunications sector. You'll then see a feed of incidents which have only impacted the telecommunications sector. At the UK at the moment, one of the main things is this targeting of 5G masts linked to the conspiracy theory regarding COVID-19. The key thing is, from an intelligence perspective, it's giving people intelligence that's relative to their sector, but also actionable. The things that we're picking out from a telecommunications side are timings of attacks, profiles of attackers, drivers. Would really dig into the whole conspiracy side of it and understand what is it that people are talking about and why are then the telecommunications sector being impacted by this. As long as you can provide tailored, actionable intelligence, that's the first step. And then it's a case of evolving the intelligence based on working with the company. I love working with new companies from new sectors. I get to completely understand their operations, what their drivers are, their short, medium, and long-term goals. And that helps me to better change how we operate from an intelligence perspective, but also build the technical tools that our clients need to make their operations more efficient. A big part of where this is all going to is customized intelligence platforms. The days of just walking into a company and saying, look, these are our solutions, pick one off the shelf, are going quickly. People want customized intelligence solutions that completely match their operations. They don't require loads of training because you've built the technology to match how they currently operate. That's where it's all evolving to.
But how do we get there? Look at where we've gone with cybersecurity. As we've moved to cloud-based solutions, we've generalized a lot of what we do. We've done a very good job of providing people with actionable intelligence and playbooks that they can react to. But to provide a commodity service, you cannot have large amounts of customization for particular customers. Given the scope and the breadth of what we're talking about here, how do you begin to evolve services that can tune effectively for a customer? Or does it become much more tuned for an industry or a location?
The sector in general has evolved so much over the past 10 years. I went from producing intelligence reports in Word documents, PDFing them, and then sending them out once a day at 6 p.m. The next stage was trying to do it through Google Earth KMZ files, so the data was far more interactive. But also, you could give the client the historical data. We've now moved on to the situation where you actually have live information, live incidents being reported, updates are being given to the clients in real time. So if there is a terrorist attack, for example, you can send them an initial situation report, but then consistently update them as to the incident is now over, give them a post-incident report as well. This is exactly what happened, and these are the learning outcomes that we can take from this as an organization. With clients who we're working with from a customization point of view, it's just taking challenges and making them far more simple. We're currently building an intelligence platform for one of the energy majors. Part of the issue they have is that they have their intelligence feed in one area, they've got documents that they have to store in another area, and we're just putting it under one platform. Everything is in a single place, which just makes it far easier, more cost-effective, and more efficient to engage with that data. The key is just taking the challenges of the organization and just simplifying them initially through technology, but also growing and learning with the client. Once we've built this solution, without a shadow of a doubt, once the client starts to use it, they'll say, right, I want to change that, or can we add this to it? It's understanding what they want, but making sure what we build them is actually what they need at the end of it, which is a big part of our job. Part of the reason why we've had the ability to grow and get a significant foothold in the sector is because we've been very light, very agile, and been able to evolve our technology to meet the changing threat landscape, which perhaps the market leaders haven't done. Going forward, it's constantly evolving technology to meet the changing threat landscape.
Compliance has become one of the restrictors of some of that sharing of information. Part of the stuff that you're gathering is human intelligence led. Now we have to think about how do we share that? How do we store that? What are the privacy and other implications, let alone the need to protect sources? How do you make that work in a global sense? Because it's relatively easy to tune that for a specific region when you're dealing with one set of compliances that do not contradict each other. At a global level, the contradiction between compliance legislation, even in the same area, is a nightmare.
There's a few things there to unpack. And the first one is it has to be intelligence doctrine led. But whenever I was going to investors and pitching intelligence fusion, the question I would always get would be, well, what about fake news? From our perspective, we've put in place the basic intelligence doctrine, which I expected to see in the sector. And in all fairness, I haven't seen. Every piece of information that we receive as part of our crowdsource network has to come with a source as to where they got that information from. It is open source. You can click on that link and anybody can view it. What we do is grade that person as an intelligence source, grade them in terms of their reliability and their credibility. The first time we receive a piece of information from somebody, we grade them as an F source, which basically means that we've had no other information from that person before. Therefore, we can't reliably assess how credible they are. The more information they give to us, the more that rating is going to change. Basic principles of intelligence, putting these in place, they help us to combat fake news. From the whole regulatory aspect of it, the way that we operate is we gather information through our internal team. So we have 8 analysts, plus we have our own crowdsource network of people who are essentially our armchair analysts who have an interest in security and intelligence. And they are searching the web, they find information, they send that information through to then be moderated by our senior team, which again is a key aspect of this. I hear about artificial intelligence and algorithmic intelligence and just how powerful it is. I think AI and the whole reputation AI has sort of garnered over the last few years is going to be impacted going forward. People are seeing it isn't this panacea that's going to change the world. We've always said you have to have a human as part of this process to ensure the accuracy of what's coming through, because there are certain nuances to intelligence, which are machine learning or algorithmic tools won't be able to pick up on. Moving forward, what we do want to do is actually build a crowdsourced network of people who are providing us information that won't come from a source. So somebody's walking down the street, they see an incident, and then they report that to us. So a key aspect of that is it comes back to the whole source grading aspect. So if historically that person's giving us 40 incidents and they've all been accurate, then we can use that as the foundation to say, well, they can't provide us information because they're actually directly watching this incident unfold. However, let's place that on the platform, but give it a caveat of this hasn't been confirmed by other sources. Another aspect of intelligence is that multiplicity and balance. Wherever possible, you want to have multiple separate sources who are providing the same information.
I suddenly come back to crisis communications. It's very easy when we look at things like disaster recovery to assume that organizations have a crisis communications plan. But as data breach after data breach has shown us, organizations have little in the way of effective crisis communications. COVID-19 has made them think a bit more about this by having this need to outreach continually to members of staff to see if they're okay. How much change do you see coming in the way people plan, execute, and deliver crisis communications going forwards?
There's two aspects to it in the word crisis and communication. The first one is crisis. You need to have an understanding of where these crises are actually occurring around the world or in comparison to your operations and your staff. And that is the other aspect. Having that ability to actually track your employees in comparison to the crises that you're actually tracking. And the last part is the whole communication part of it. Once you are aware of this incident that is occurring, you are informing that staff member there is an incident occurring within a proximity of where you are, and consistently providing them additional information and updates so that they are aware of what to do in that situation, whether it's a case of, look, this incident's happening at this location, you're probably not going to be impacted, so just stay in your location at the moment and we'll continue to update you until we're in a position to actually say, right, you can now move on to the location you're heading to, as an example. Those are the three aspects. One, understanding the actual incidents, the crisis. Two, understanding where your staff are. The third part of it is the communication aspect and ensuring that you're not just sending, you're receiving as well from your staff member. The whole two-way relationship from a security perspective of saying, we know where you are, this incident is happening, and now we're going to support you whilst we kind of get you through whatever is happening in that location. The worry for us as intelligence analysts is that the world is becoming far more threat-rich. This is certainly something that businesses should be looking at from a duty of care perspective, which was made a lot easier when everybody was operating out of a single office in a single location. All you had to worry about was them getting to and from the office. It makes it far more worse when they're all operating from their home, because you then have multiple proximities that you should be monitoring from a duty of care perspective and having that communication with your employee to provide that support.
But there's another aspect. If this is about constant duty of care and updating people on what's going on, the first is, can we supply this as a service that staff members can opt in and out of? I ask that because unless you are a national drug testing authority and dealing with athletes, Your staff are not going to tell you where they're going to be at any given point in time on any given day, especially if it's their day off or they're on holiday. As we know historically, these are where people get caught out because they have no situational awareness of that environment. The second part of that goes to the privacy. How do we maintain the privacy of members of staff if we're gathering information and pushing this out? Even if they opt in as a service, we need to make sure that they're just pulling data. They're not disclosing stuff.
It's a massively difficult question. It has to be done with the consent of the employee, the staff member. Traditionally, I've worked with companies who are operating in hostile environments, so they are far happier to provide that sort of information to be constantly monitored because the threat is so high. Part of it comes down to education and staff members understanding this is the threat. This is the threat environment. These are the things that are actually happening in the proximity of where your home location is, but also where you're traveling to the office and potentially once you're actually going on business trips, if that's going to happen in the future. These are the sorts of threats that you're facing there. It has to be done through education and saying to them, you know, this is the situation. And then hopefully you can get that consent. Ultimately, what you're trying to do is support them and make sure that they are safe and they don't have issues on this trip. However, when a major incident does happen, that's when suddenly that person says, I wish I'd opted in to be actually tracked. It's massively difficult because you have this whole sort of big brother mindset and people are really worried about constantly being monitored and what they can find. Technology companies have caused part of this issue by overstepping the mark in certain things that they're actually collecting on people. It then causes us a headache from a security perspective, trying to keep people safe. It has to be done through education, but it has to come from the employee to say, I'm happy to be tracked during this period.
If I stay with that disaster recovery theme, one of the issues is if I'm building a new data center, I look at the risk of flood, of earthquake, of fire, of all those physical elements around me. How much local intelligence are your clients now asking for? I'm thinking of a conversation you and I had a while back where you talked about one city where you were recording grenade explosions.
That city being Stockholm, which is always very surprising to people. The world is changing significantly, and that is a real key thing for us. It's really understanding the dynamics as to how the threat situation is changing. And to come back to Stockholm, what you have is organized criminal groups who are using grenades as an extortion tactic. They'll turn around to a business and say, give us some money. If you don't, we're going to attack your business with a grenade. When they don't, that is what is happening. They're also using it to target police. You will see police stations being targeted in Sweden with grenades or with IEDs. What happens is, and we've seen this in a couple of scenarios, where the police have actually moved out of that area and it's increased the freedom of movement of the criminal elements that operate there. People are all surprised when they see that grenade map of Stockholm. But for us, because we look at Europe and America and the world in such detail, these are the sort of the patterns and trends that we pull out. We're advising our clients, look, if you do go to this location, it's not just low-level criminality you might face. There is the possibility of these incidents targeting business. It's very much understanding the world and how the world is changing. I mentioned the autonomous zone previously in Seattle. That is a new dynamic that we're witnessing, but we are seeing more autonomous zones trying to be created in the US. There was one in Portland last week, and I can see that only increasing going forward. It's a constant issue and a dynamic for us to understand what groups are operating in a certain area, what are their drivers, what is their capability intent, what weapon systems do they have access to, from a criminality perspective, what types of crimes are they committing? And then looking at the business and saying to them, based on your profile, you may be targeted or you may not be targeted, or there is a likelihood or a significant likelihood or a low likelihood. It's all about understanding the business and then understanding the threat landscape and marrying the two together.
One of the dangers of being exposed to large amounts of intelligence is that you tend to see the darker side of everything. The reality for most organizations is that a lot of this won't touch them or their staff at all. How do you reassure customers coming to you that whilst you may have one view on a situation that looks really bad, that doesn't mean the whole situation is devolving?
It's about consistency of data. I come back to Sweden as an example. Some of our competitors in the marketplace produce this annual threat map. Sweden is always categorized as being low threat. But there are certain parts of Sweden which are not low threat areas. It gives away an inaccurate representation of the threat. A key thing for us has always been, we operate at the tactical level of intelligence. It's things that are happening on the ground, geolocating them as accurately as possible. The next level up you've got is the operational level, which looks at a country, and then strategic level, you're looking at a region. The key thing for us is gathering that consistency of data so you can understand these incidents occurring, but who were they against? Often it's either criminal elements targeting criminal elements or the police, but yes, sometimes businesses are targeted. It's understanding in that relationship how much and how often the businesses are targeted. The key thing always comes down to that consistency of data. All too often in this sector, people have based their intelligence analyses on the more qualitative side of intelligence, so just reading reports, whereas we come at it from a very much quantitative side. It's actually looking at incidents on a regular basis and picking out that pattern and that trend. There's a balancing line between it. If you read the mainstream media, you'll not pick up the majority of what we collect. Whereas if you just completely read our platform without any background, you might just look at the world and not want to leave your house. It's having that middle ground of understanding you have to look at our platform in the context of your business and your operation. The majority of incidents we record on our platform, it's criminal group against criminal group. You should be more well read as to what the threat landscape looks like, because often it might surprise you.
I think as we go forward from here, the lessons people are learning from duty of care of staff, the lessons about the increased risk of security when you suddenly change your operating model, and now in the real world, as we're seeing an increased shift in physical risks, the type of intelligence that you're producing is going to be critical for people.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you for talking with us today, Michael.
No, thanks very much for your time, Ian.